or a summer and a semester. In many of the cases, I get teachers who are only there for a semester, especially when they're in-service teachers coming back late in the afternoons after they've taught all day. But they really are keen. And this proverb sort of says it all. We can lecture, we can demonstrate things, we can show pictures, but students who actually get hands-on, get their minds on, they grasp and they grapple, and the result is a level of understanding that is not going to be achieved. And I'm again preaching to the choir here. We hear the term independent research. It's a nice buzzword, but I don't think it's really a realistic thing. As I said, undergraduates are keen, but they are also clueless, in my experience. By and large, they are totally inexperienced. They've had a lot of academic coursework. They're used to taking multiple choice exams. They're used to reading assignments, and very few of them have read any primary literature and had any experience. So we all remember that our best teachers were those who invested time in us, and that's the whole idea. So it's sort of like building any structure. Getting started is hard. There's an enormous number of topics out there, and the approach to it varies, and I'm going to now shift gears a little bit. What has worked in our lab with this small cadre of undergraduates that come every semester. We take a strategy which we call the four questions approach to sort of narrow down the topics. Now, I mean, I have sort of a hidden agenda here because I actually have a topic, a broad topic that I'm going to steer them toward, but it's still a useful exercise. The first question we sit and talk about, what interests you? Are you interested in beetles, bugs, wasps, butterflies? Well, let's just take this as an example, butterflies. Next question, what do butterflies do? And you can fill in the blank. What does blank do? Beetles, wasps, butterflies, bugs, spiders. And you can even narrow it further down, a particular kind of butterfly. And shown here, of course, is just the life cycle of a butterfly. Obviously, they have the life cycle. And those different stages in the life cycle provide opportunities for productive inquiry. At every stage, you can work with the ovipositing female, you can work with the mating behavior, you can work with the, just point out an interesting thing here, the pupae, when they form their chrysalids, depends somewhat on the substrate that they find themselves on, and you get quite a range from dark to light. And so if you say, what do? It helps to spend a bit of time and actually send the students away and say, you know, come on back now with a list and brainstorm. Very effective technique. This is a partial list. It could go on and on and on and on. Any one of these can be developed into a research project. You can talk about what the larva is doing. You can talk about the mating behavior of the adults, molting. How much time, how much space, what about the habitat preferences, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Any number of options. And this brainstorming stage helps generate some ideas in the student's brain, and they begin to see, don't know much about this. For example, once you've got a list, and perhaps they've settled in on maybe they're interested in caterpillar behavior. The next thing to start considering as you develop a project is what things can be manipulated related to butterflies. And one question is food preference. Well, the other thing that I started to mention earlier is that we don't get many tangible benefits, and we don't have any budget. And so you're basically scabbing off of research grant money or the limited supplies budget you got. So you're always looking, especially when you work with teachers, this is not a problem because that's the way teachers have to operate in the public schools. But you don't need a lot of money. So here's a simple thing that could lead to a whole undergraduate research project. Depending on what species, they might choose the painted lady butterfly, they might choose a cabbage butterfly or some other, even the monarch. And they can go to work and take and stick that caterpillar right in the center and start recording data. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. Or there's things you can do with the adults. For example, butterflies will lay eggs. They are very oriented to the chemistry of the host plants. And what didn't show on the in the lower left down here, and I'm not sure, this is from putting it on a Mac, I guess. But this was just to show that we had a choice of between lettuce and cabbage. And the butterfly, as you can see, ovipositates after making sensory contact with its forelegs on the leaf, bends around to lay the egg on the underside of the leaf and lays it on the film canister plastic. And very clearly a choice is made. Well, again, this part of the brainstorming and ideas, possibilities, just with one example. And then the fourth question in this series is to get the student to work up a list of what things are going to be needed to work on a particular question. And my point here is simply to stress that you don't need a lot of fancy equipment. You have access to nice equipment, and you can certainly use that, but it's not a requirement for a successful undergraduate research project. Especially since I'm in the field of basically insect behavior, the best equipment you have is your pair of eyes. So equipment ranges from what? The question also comes up with students as to whether they should work in the field or in the laboratory. And over the years, I have come to prefer laboratory just because it's a lot more reliable. You don't have weather issues, you don't have transportation issues, you don't have as many safety issues. It's basically easier to monitor. There are many wonderful field projects, and I guess if I were an insect ecologist, I would have students out doing transects, or if I were a crop entomologist, we'd be doing stuff out in the plots. But if you're trying to do behavior in the field, it's a lot iffier. Depends on having a nice day, having insects at the right stage, etc., and things happening. So I've always, in recent years, tend to lean toward the laboratory, and which insect to study is the next question. And here's where I take those four questions and slowly say, why don't we do something that interests me, my graduate students, and try to plug in projects that work there. But I don't have an absolute and hard rule on that. I've had a number of students take on projects that had nothing to do with my direct research interests, and they've been very successful at it. It's, again, as you saw, very mature student, knew what he wanted to do, able to get right in and go for it. And when you've got students like that, it's fantastic. And if you've got a clueless student, sometimes if you're going to get anywhere, it's good to just give them a little bit of direction. So I'm going to conclude just by talking briefly about the wow bugs and why this has been such a great organism to use for students in the laboratory, because they can get meaningful results, they can get into the project right away, and one of the benefits is that the life cycle is quick, 25 days from egg to adult, and when you get the adults out, it's a gregarious parasitoid wasp is what the wow bug is, and you have 500 plus adults. So if a student manages to kill a few, as it happened, or a few escape in the process of handling, it's no big deal. And if nothing goes right that first experiment, you start another culture and you've got more, and you've still got a few weeks left in the semester to get some data and get some projects. So during the first 3 weeks, in fact, after we've done that first activity of answering those four questions and brainstorming a bit, and I've steered them to wild bugs, and we specifically brainstorm about wild bugs, they get acquainted with the organism. They're given a culture, given the wasp, given the host, and told to make a culture, watch it, take observations, learn how to handle it, and in the same time start to refine that research question that they're going to ultimately look at. That weekly lab meeting serves to sort of keep them on track. They become aware of what the graduate students are doing. They've started to read some of the literature that's maybe lying around the lab. And I put this one in mainly just to point out that this poster was an undergraduate research project. We got a student from the art department who was doing a double major between scientific illustration and biology and wanted a project. And so he went through this same whole process and ultimately produced a series of drawings and put it together into a poster. He would bring drafts of the drawings and we'd say, well, you better take another look under the microscope and see what you see. This is not quite the way it is. And it was it turned out to be a very interesting project, and this poster is probably going to be produced commercially and sold with the wild bugs that Carolina Biological sells 365 days of the year. So this 3 weeks immersion with wild bugs, they find them really to be quite novel and different, and they become aware of many facets of their biology. For example, the sexual dimorphism. The male's eye is essentially vestigial. He's got weird antennae. He turns out to be rare. There's only 3 males and 97 females in that culture. And he's going to mate with all of his sisters. And in the process, he's only 3 males, but he fights with his brothers, and he usually kills one, and there may only end up to be one. Here's one that's been decapitated and is latched onto the hind tarsus of that guy. Nevertheless, he's quite able. We actually watched him mate with a series of the females. It's a highly inbred system. Well, there's a lot of biological richness in this system, and the good news is that from research, very little is actually published. There's not a lot known, and in addition to this species, we have 5 other species in this genus that we keep in culture in the laboratory, so that there's a lot of options to take this. But before they go too far, we throw in another writing assignment that we evolved a few years ago, because critical thinking is something we're trying to get these undergraduates to do. They're no longer in the lecture, they're trying to think about a research project and a question, and it really helps to have them go through the process, write down what question it is, come up with a hypothesis. And we talk about this in the weekly lab meetings, and they see examples of it. What variables are you going to change? What's going to be kept constant? If you're going to have a little experimental design, give us a sketch, list the materials, and what kinds of specific things do you want to observe? What are you going to measure? Because you've got to quantify stuff if you're doing it, and how are you going to record the data, and even go so far as to think about how your data are going to look. How are you going to record that in your lab book or notebook? And it's always a big eye-opener when you get these back. It reminds you 9 times out of 10 how naive the students are and why they're there and why you're being useful. I circled with red some of the comments that I made, and I apologize if you can't quite read all of this, but the student, for example, says, what variables will remain constant? One side of the Y-form will be at room temperature. Well, no, this is going to be one of the things that you're supposed to change in the third question. And what measurements will you take? Well, they didn't put any measurements. You got to quantify something. The student says to see how long the wild bug takes to move from cold environment to another. And so you take this as a starting point, because every student, and some of them are very sophisticated, and there's not any one particular experiment that we're trying to lead them to. We want them to come up with something that interests them, and they will come up with something that interests them, and most likely something that's never been done before. And by this process of going back and forth, they come to evolve a fairly decent project in a fairly short time. Finally, when we get toward the end of the semester, it's time to communicate the results. And just like we've heard at other institutions, the University of Georgia has a program which is called CURO. It's the Center for Undergraduate Research Opportunities, and they hold an annual student research symposium. And we make it clear at the beginning, in fact, in all the materials that advertise undergraduate research, that participation in CURO with a poster or an oral presentation is going to be expected. And that involves quite a lot of time as well. Once the student has got the data, then we've got the analysis to go through, some simple statistical things, and scientific writing. And for most of them, they've never had to write a paper in college and never had to write a research style. There's a lot that goes into this whole aspect, and one could do the whole talk on scientific writing. It differs in a lot of ways from the way they wrote their term papers in English. We all know that, but the students are often fairly surprised. We have our own jargon. I think you can read this. We tend to, I think we can all see ourselves in some of these phrases. So in the end, we want to help these students to metamorphose into successful scientists. We don't want them just to pupate. And I think it's imperative, again, and I'm again talking, preaching to the choir, tomorrow's scientists are in our classrooms today, and it's a pretty darn awesome responsibility. So that said, those of us who spend a lot of our time mentoring undergraduate research, hopefully, and I have plenty of evidence and feedback from students over the years that it has indeed made a difference, and we heard several students testify to that today, and that's what keeps you going as the professor even without any real tangible rewards. So thanks to all those undergraduate guinea pigs and to the wild bugs. All of them have taught me very much, and thanks again for inviting me to be a part of this symposium.
To talk about some studies we've been doing with yellow star thistle to look at the impact of a guild of seed feeders that we've introduced against yellow star thistle in cooperation with the USDA ARS, who handled the host testing and the introduction of these agents. So Joe gave a good introduction into yellow star thistle as a pest in the western United States, and I'll just try to repeat as little of that as possible. But it is, California is the place where yellow star thistle seems to be the most abundant, and it occurs over 5 million hectares in California alone. It produces multiple flower heads, but unlike the other knapweeds, the yellow star thistle has long, sharp spines, and these are actually hard spines, and they're quite pointed and uncomfortable, and so not only disliked by grazing animals, but they're also disliked by hikers and others, recreational people as well. We've introduced a total of 7 insects introduced, and all of them have been seed head feeders. Of them, only 6 established. Yellow star thistle is an annual, unlike the other knapweeds, which are biennials or short-lived perennials. Yellow star thistle is an annual, and it's an obligate outcrosser, and it reproduces solely by seed. And so it is not, does not self, but rather requires pollen from other plants to produce fertile seeds. It produces 2 types of seeds, a brown seed with pappus, which is found in the side, the middle of the head, and then black seed, naked seed, which is on the around the outside of the head. And I'll mention that in more detail in a bit. And seed production in individual plants can change by orders of 3 orders of magnitude. So we can have very, very large plants with tens of thousands of seeds, and we can have a single plant with only 10 seeds or even 1 seed if we want. So here's a picture of the seeds or the achenes of yellow star thistle. And you can see how yellow star thistle looks like a knapweed. It has that characteristic white nap that's in the center of the head. The pappus seed has these long setae that come out the top, and they occur in the center of the head. And then the naked black seeds occur on the outside of the head. And so actually there's 2 kinds of florets that are formed. They're actually all the same floret, it's just that technically, but they produce a different kind of seed. And there's the ratio between the two is approximately 3 to 1, 3 to 3 pappus seed to 1 non-pappus seed. And the seed head feeders all attack this seed, the immature stages of these seed head buds, and the larvae crawl are inside the head and destroy and consume the seed. So in order to understand how possible efforts of control, we wanted to look at the seed bank. And this is a study that was done in the late 1990s and early 2000. And the blue lines are the pappus-bearing seed. And we started out with around 12,000. We went to an area, and we marked off with a fence of about 20, meters by 20 meters. And it wasn't necessarily a dense patch of yellowstone thistle, but it wasn't a light patch either. It was about medium or representative of the of this area. And this is an area that's ungrazed. It's in a riparian area that's along a creek, but up in the higher area that's not flooded actually by the creek. So we roped off an area of about 20 meters by 20 meters, and then we went in with the hand scythe and we cut down any plants that would bolt, so there'd actually be no seed production of any kind.